Well, when you are asked a difficult or a complex question, how do you tend to respond? What approach do you take? Some kinds of people seek to respond with a thoughtful and logical answer that just simply explains their thoughts or their beliefs on the question at hand. This is the kind of answer we're looking for when we Google a question, right? Something straightforward and direct, as much as possible. No frills, just a satisfactory explanation. Other kinds of people will do something completely different. They'll tell a story. When I was in college, my campus minister was one of these kinds of people. We'd be sitting down, eating lunch or sipping coffee, and I'd ask him a complex theological question, and suddenly I find myself listening to a story about the time that he and his friend Tim took a road trip to Montreal. Well, some of you are rolling your eyes because you know these kinds of people and they annoy you. You just want a simple answer. But I'd like to remind you that a great example of this kind of person is Jesus. And also me. I often do this too, but more importantly, Jesus. Anyways, why? Why would you take a question that could be answered with a much more straightforward explanation and instead tell a story? Well, because big questions often require big answers. And sometimes small questions do too. Because stories tell us the truth in a different and often a fuller way than a straightforward explanation does. They make us think on a deeper level. They take our initial questions and they force us to ask even deeper and better questions. They draw us in, they catch us off guard, and they hit us with stuff that we would not have considered otherwise. And I think this is why God didn't give us a manual or just a theological treatise. He gave us a story. And it's a story that contains within itself a multitude of stories. As we explore one more element of this resurrection life, we're going to take a look at a particular story in the Bible. It's a story that I'm sad to say is often overlooked. It's the story of Ruth. Now, the book of Ruth is an amazing story, and we won't have time this morning to read the entire thing, but I do have an education degree, and so that gives me license to assign homework. So your homework this week is to read Ruth. It's four chapters. Take a half an hour, sit down, and read the whole thing. There's so much there that's worth reflecting on. This morning, we'll do some digging around in the story of Ruth. Now, this is also a very misunderstood story in the way that many contemporary readers approach it, both because of ideas that are misconstrued and also because of things in the story and its context that are missed or overlooked altogether. You'll hear people talk about the book of Ruth as if it's an ancient Hebrew version of a romantic comedy or Pride and Prejudice. And that's not at all what this story is about. And when we read those ideas into it, we actually miss the power that it has to speak to the biggest questions of life. Who is God? And what does it mean to follow him, to be his people? When we miss these things in Old Testament stories like Ruth, we miss some of their power when we get to the Gospels and the story of Jesus. So let's take a look. Now, I'd give you my own personal synopsis of the introduction that sets the scene, the background for the story, but there's actually no way I would use fewer words than the author of Ruth does. So let's read from the beginning of chapter 1. In the days when the judges ruled, there was a famine in the land. So a man from Bethlehem in Judah, together with his wife and two sons, went to live for a while in the country of Moab. The man's name was Elimelech, his wife's name was Naomi, and the names of his two sons were Mahlon and Chilion. They were Ephrathites from Bethlehem, Judah, and they went to Moab and lived there. Now, Elimelech, Naomi's husband, died, and she was left with her two sons. They married Moabite women, one named Orpah and the other Ruth. After they had lived there about 10 years, both Mahlon and Chilion also died, and Naomi was left without her two sons and her husband. This is the very bleak and tragic beginning of the story of Ruth. We read on. When Naomi heard in Moab that the Lord had come to the aid of his people by providing food for them, she and her daughters-in-law prepared to return home from there. With her two daughters-in-law, she left the place where she had been living and set out on the road that would take them back to the land of Judah. Then Naomi said to her two daughters-in-law, Go back, each of you, to your mother's home. May the Lord show you kindness as you have shown kindness to your dead husbands and to me. May the Lord grant that each of you will find rest in the home of another husband. Then she kissed them goodbye, and they wept aloud and said to her, "We will go back with you to your people." But Naomi said, "Return home, my daughters. Why would you come with me? Am I going to have any more sons who could become your husbands? Return home, my daughters. I am too old to have another husband. Even if I thought there was still hope for me, even if I had a husband tonight and then gave birth to sons, would you wait until they grew up? Would you remain unmarried for them? No, my daughters, it is more bitter for me than for you, because the Lord's hand has turned against me." At this, they wept aloud again. Then Orpah kissed her mother-in-law goodbye, but Ruth clung to her. "Look," said Naomi, "your sister-in-law is going back to her people and her gods. Go back with her." But Ruth replied, "Don't urge me to leave you or to turn back from you. Where you go, I will go, and where you stay, I will stay. Your people will be my people, and your God, my God. Where you die, I will die, and there I will be buried. May the Lord deal with me, be it ever so severely, if even death separates you and me." When Naomi realized that Ruth was determined to go with her, she stopped urging her. Now Naomi is utterly devastated. She looks at her circumstances and interprets the idea that God's hand has turned against her. When she returns to Bethlehem, she tells everyone not to call her Naomi anymore, which means sweet or pleasant. She says instead call her Mara, which means bitter. And trust me when I say that she's not being melodramatic. She had left her home to escape a famine, moved to a country that was a historic enemy of her people, more on that later, and instead of finding refuge in this foreign land, she lost her husband and both of her sons. For a woman in the ancient world, the loss of the men in her life was essentially the loss of all hope. Without a husband or a son to provide for her, she was destitute. A childless widow, too old to remarry, had no value in society and found herself extraordinarily vulnerable. Her most likely future included some combination of extreme poverty, forced prostitution, abuse, homelessness, and starvation. She begins her trek towards her hometown of Bethlehem along a trail that inevitably became drenched with tears. And following her are her two daughters-in-law, Orpah and Ruth. These young women, who also both find themselves in the devastating situation of being without children or a husband, likely felt a sense of obligation to Naomi as their mother-in-law, of which she releases them and urges them to take advantage of their youth, to go back to their native country and marry again, to find a better life at home. And Orpah, having been released, turns around and goes home. Now, Orpah can get a bad rap here, and I want to set the record straight. Orpah is a good, loyal daughter-in-law. She stays with Naomi until Naomi herself insists that she leave. She simply looks bad when we hold her against Ruth and what Ruth does. What Ruth does is something wildly unexpected and culturally outrageous. Not only does she refuse to leave Naomi in this moment, not only is she determined to accompany Naomi to Bethlehem, she pledges her loyalty to Naomi for the rest of her life. And she seals this pledge with an appeal to God, the God of Naomi's people. Ruth has nothing to gain from this move. Naomi has nothing to offer her. This is a wholly selfless act of sacrificial and loyal love towards Naomi. No one would have imagined that she would do this, let alone expect it. This is not normal. It isn't now, and it wasn't then. This is absolutely shocking. Now, there's an important Hebrew word that we see here in the beginning of the book of Ruth. The first time that Naomi tells Ruth and Orpah to leave her and go home, she says, "May the Lord show you kindness, as you have shown kindness to your husbands and to me." The word translated here as kindness is the Hebrew word hesed. And hesed is an amazing word. This is one of those beautiful Hebrew words that you kind of pronounce in the back of your throat, hesed. And hesed causes a bit of trouble for translators, because there's no word in English, and perhaps not in any language, that is fit to capture the range of meaning of the word hesed. English Bibles frequently use loving kindness or steadfast love, but these words contain only a sliver of the full meaning of hesed. It is loyalty, faithfulness, kindness, goodness, mercy, love, and compassion, all wrapped up in one word. Hesed is an active form of love that goes far, far beyond what is expected or deserved. And this is what Ruth is doing. She is showing Naomi hesed. And that forces the question, why? What could possibly inspire Ruth to go so far out of her way, to risk everything for the sake of Naomi? I've sat with this question as I've pondered the book of Ruth through the years, and I am venturing into some speculation here, but consider this with me. When Ruth and Naomi arrive in Bethlehem in chapter 2, Ruth decides to go out and find a field where she can glean some food to sustain Naomi and herself. Now, gleaning was a practice written into the law that God gave to Israel through Moses that required the owner of a field to leave the corners of the field alone when crops were ready to be harvested. And this was a system of radical generosity designed to be built into the cultural fabric of Israel's society. Those who, the poor in the community and those who did not own land and could not afford to purchase food from those who did, were invited to come along and harvest some of those remaining crops for themselves. Why? Because God is full of hesed and desires that all are provided for. And it appears that in the 10 years she was married to an Israelite man, Ruth learned something of this God and the character qualities that define him and his people. So what inspired Ruth's act of loyal love towards Naomi? I think Ruth was captivated by this God full of hesed who cares so deeply for his people, for all of his people, so much that she made a choice in that moment to bind herself to him and to his people. Hesed is arguably one of the most significant words in the Old Testament. It's used 247 times all over the Old Testament. God speaks it. The Psalms sing of it. The prophets call for it. Over and over, we see this picture of radical hesed love. And 2/3 of those 247 times hesed is used are references to God showing hesed to his people, because this is who God is. God says this about himself in Exodus 34. The Lord, the compassionate and gracious God, slow to anger, abounding in hesed and faithfulness. David echoes this in Psalm 36. Your hesed, Lord, reaches to the heavens, your faithfulness to the skies. Isaiah 63, I will tell of the hesed of the Lord, the deeds for which he is to be praised, according to all the Lord has done for us. Yes, the many good things he has done for Israel, according to his compassion and hesed. And on and on and on. My personal favorite translation of hesed comes from the Hebrew Bible scholar Walter Brueggemann. He calls this tenacious solidarity. I think this is the perfect way to put it. This is a God who comes to be among his people, who acts on their behalf, who liberates them, who stands with them and for them over and over with an unrelenting tenacity. And the more marginalized someone becomes, the more vulnerable, the more overlooked they are by others, the more passionately God intervenes on their behalf. Brueggemann says this, God is in tenacious solidarity with Israel in the Old Testament, particularly with widows and orphans and immigrants and poor people. God is tenaciously in solidarity with them and with the community that participates in God's faithfulness. I love that, participates in God's faithfulness. Well, this is a good moment to note more thoroughly who Ruth is. She is a Moabite. The narrator will not let us forget this. Over and over, she is referred to as Ruth the Moabite. At one point, someone even calls her the Moabite who came back from Moab. The Moabite from Moab. Okay, we get the point, but there's a backstory here that helps us understand why it's such a big deal to Israelites that Ruth is not only a foreigner, but more specifically a Moabite. The original Moab, who became the namesake of his descendants, was the son of Abraham's nephew Lot, who was born out of a, let's just say a complicated and shady situation. Centuries later, when the newly rescued Israelites were on their way from Egypt to the Promised Land, and they passed through the land of Moab, many Israelites were drawn into the worship of idols by the Moabites. And later the Moabites, along with the Ammonites, hired a prophet named Balaam to pronounce a curse on Israel. You may remember this as the story with the talking donkey. Israel's law stated this: no Ammonite or Moabite or any of their descendants may enter the assembly of the Lord, not even in the 10th generation, for they did not come to meet you with bread and water on your way when you came out of Egypt. And they hired Balaam, son of Beor, from Pethor in Aram, Naharaim, to pronounce a curse on you. However, the Lord your God would not listen to Balaam, but turned the curse into a blessing for you, because the Lord your God loves you. Do not seek a treaty of friendship with them as long as you live. So when Ruth arrives in Bethlehem, she finds herself on the wrong side of a long and complex family drama. She also finds herself the widow of a man whose family abandoned their homeland and their people in a time of crisis to seek shelter among some of their most bitter enemies. And in light of all of this, it's not a surprise that the folks in Bethlehem are constantly reminding each other where this Ruth comes from. And yet, despite her background, despite this family history and the ill will that many had towards her and her people, Ruth is not the only one who demonstrates hesed in this story. Ruth the Moabite also finds herself on the receiving end of an act of hesed. When Ruth goes out to glean, well, she just so happens to find herself in the field of a wealthy and respected man named Boaz, who just so happens to be related to her late husband. Boaz is known by his neighbors as a Gibor Hael, a man of valor. That Ruth is a Moabite doesn't seem to shake Boaz up. When he sees her gleaning in his field with others, he goes out of his way to provide more than enough food for her to have her fill and take plenty home to Naomi. Boaz was amazed and inspired by Ruth's act of hesed towards Naomi. The Gibor Hael, the man of valor, takes note that Ruth the Moabite is an Eshet Hael, a woman of valor. And after a fascinating series of events, Boaz agrees to marry Ruth. Ruth the Moabite, Ruth the foreigner, Ruth the enemy, or Ruth the woman of valor who knows this God of Hesed and embodies his love in such a way that blows the minds and captures the hearts of this Israelite community and their descendants for centuries to come. Now, I wish we had more time to thoroughly explore the dynamics of what this marriage means, but for now, suffice it to say that this is not the star-crossed romance we often make it out to be. I've heard single women exhorted to wait for your Boaz, which is very interesting because Ruth most certainly does not wait for her Boaz, who, by the way, was almost certainly not what we would consider to be an eligible bachelor. This story isn't in the Bible to give us dating advice. There's something far more amazing going on here than that. This marriage is about two things. First, through Boaz, both Ruth and Naomi are ensured to be provided for. These two childless widows with no hope of self-preservation were now given hope and a future marked by flourishing. Boaz acts with hesed towards Ruth and Naomi. But the story ends with something even bigger happening. See, one of the tragedies of this situation that Ruth and Naomi have found themselves in is that without living sons to carry on the family line, the line of Elimelech is cut off forever. Elimelech, in all likelihood, would not long after have been forgotten entirely. Naomi would have died alone and destitute in the grief that her family story went to the grave with her. This implication doesn't hit us in our culture today the same way it did for the ancient world. For them, this is probably the worst nightmare that one can imagine. And instead of this tragic conclusion, here is what happens. So Boaz took Ruth, and she became his wife. When he made love to her, the Lord enabled her to conceive, and she gave birth to a son. The women said to Naomi, "Praise be to the Lord, who this day has not left you without a guardian redeemer. May he become famous throughout Israel. He will renew your life and sustain you in your old age. For your daughter-in-law, who loves you and who is better to you than seven sons, has given him birth." Then Naomi took the child in her arms and cared for him. The women living there said, Naomi has a son. The family line is restored as this son, though he was fathered and provided for by Boaz, was by cultural practice, according to God's law, placed in the line of Elimelech. Naomi, who was once bitter and empty and completely alone, rejoices over this miracle of hesed from God through the hesed of Ruth and Boaz. But this wasn't just an act of hesed towards this one family. God's work in this story is even more expansive. We read on about this unexpected and much celebrated son of Ruth. And they named him Obed. He was the father of Jesse, the father of David. That's right, not only did this family line live on, but in just two more generations, by the orchestration of God, this family, the family that was very nearly altogether snuffed out, would become a royal line. This is amazing. And if you know the overarching story of the Bible, you know that God's hesed through this family doesn't end with King David. Many generations later, there would be another son born in Bethlehem, another descendant of Ruth, an even greater king, through whom God would redeem and rescue the whole world. What is Jesus if not God's ultimate act of hesed? Let's take a look again at the list I gave earlier of English words that are wrapped up in hesed. Loyalty, faithfulness, kindness, goodness, mercy, love, and compassion, far beyond what is expected or deserved. This is Jesus. This is the incarnation. This is the good news that Jesus spoke of and demonstrated throughout his life. This is the crucifixion. This is the resurrection. And this is the invitation into resurrection life. Paul reminds us this in Romans, as we were reminded again last week by Alan, that God demonstrates his own love, his own hesed, for us in this. While we were still sinners, Christ died for us. In Jesus, we are drawn into God's love. We experience his hesed, and we're transformed by it. And then, like Ruth, like Boaz, like the faithful people of God through the centuries, we are called into the mission of embodying and enacting hesed to the world around us. And this is a high calling. It requires selflessness and sacrifice. It requires, as Paul says in Philippians, the valuing of others' well-being above our own. It requires creativity and innovation to meet complex problems and conflicts with transformative hesed love. But as we go deeper into life with the God who overflows with hesed, we're giving an abundance that is meant to pour out of ourselves to our neighbor. And not just to our neighbor, but even to our neighbors on the wrong side of the many lines that have been drawn. The story of Ruth is set in the time of the judges. The narrator of the book of Judges tells us multiple times that in those days there was no king in Israel and everyone did what was right in their own eyes. The stories in those pages are marked by bitter conflict, by abhorrent violence, by deep division. Friends, we know something about this kind of self-serving, divisive culture of violence. We know something about a world where generational wounds are left to fester, where the vulnerable are left with nothing, where each person pursues what they want for themselves. But the king is on his throne. King Jesus calls us to something more, to a completely different kind of life. And one day, paraphrasing the prophet Habakkuk, hesed will fill the earth as waters cover the seas. And in the meantime, until that great day, may we, CAC, be Ruths in our day. May we be the hands and feet of God's hesed that points the way to life, to this resurrection life.